Think of all the different things. There's a real technical term I learned in school. Think of all the different events that have happened in our life that have involved weather. And whenever that comes up, you know, we go to the Terry Spees of the world, and Terry Spees relies on the National Weather Service, and Terry's got a background here at the National Weather Service as well. And so, you know, whether it's a river forecast, whether it's, you know, like we're going through right now with farmers ripping out their hair trying to get out in the field, this place becomes a brokerage house for information and long-range planning that matters. And it matters a lot. And in my conversations off air with Mark, I always wanted to know more about it. And he finally said to me, he says, come. You know, it isn't like we're in some tower somewhere. Get in your pickup and drive up here. Come on up, you know, and get in the cruiser and come. Come up to the National Weather Service. And I'm here with Mark Ewens right now. Mark, thanks for the invitation.
Joel, I'm glad you could make it up here. Certainly do appreciate you taking the time and doing the show from up here. Been looking forward to this for a long time.
It's really intimidating. I have to tell you, it is. You know, I knew that there was a science to it, Mark, but it is incredible what you have here.
Well, it is fun. I mean, I've been doing this almost 40 years now, and it's changed so dramatically from when I started in the Air Force back in the mid-70s to where we are today. It's something I never tire of. There are days I wonder why I do it, simply because you're trying to outguess God on a regular basis. But aside from that, it's fun.
So tell people what this place does, so they have an understanding. You know, they hear terms and they hear voices and they hear projections, but tell them what this place is really about.
Well, the National Weather Service is a federal agency. Let's get that out at the outset. We are a part of the Department of Commerce, NOAA, who is our parent organization, but above all, we are a public service organization. We are here to provide watches, warnings, weather forecasts, primarily for the protection of life and property. That's kind of our number one goal, but also to provide information to the public about climate change, about how to be safe during tornadoes, severe weather, what to do when certain things occur, to provide guidance to help keep people safe in the short term and the long term. But we also are here to answer everyday questions. Part of our job is we get walk-ins, we get emails from folks asking, what was the weather on June the 5th, 1910? Folks that contact us from law enforcement that are perhaps doing investigations into accidents and they wish to know the weather conditions. And we would cover a wide range of areas. Hydrology, you talked about the flood forecasting aspect. That's part of the under the purview of the Weather Service. We do that on a daily basis across the country. Obviously, here in the Red River Valley, we're a little unique. Our river flows the wrong way. So that has a whole set of unique challenges as well. We also maintain a cooperative weather observer network program, which is something that's of big importance to me because that's a big part of my job. These are volunteer men and women. You never hear about them. They're kind of in the background. They record weather information for us on a daily basis that goes into our forecast, our warning verification process, but also our climatology. So when someone comes and says, what was the weather on June the 10th of 1910, we can pull the weather records from someone who took that observation back in that day. So it's a multifaceted job, never boring.
Yeah, I was thinking yesterday about, and you were saying you were short some volunteers in some areas. And, of course, everybody thinks of home, you know, at times like this. I was thinking of a woman back home that lives on the lake where I live, very intelligent, very, and I don't mean to volunteer, but she tracks and monitors the weather all the time. And she logs this stuff. And so those are the type of people you need to help even do your job, and you can get that information from.
That's correct. And for example, the Weather Service cooperates with an organization that's actually out of Fort Collins called the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, CoCoRAS, kind of a funny name.
But everything in government's got one of those.
Well, you know, some people say NOAA, our parent organization, is the National Organization for the Advancement of Acronyms. And, you know, we kind of go along with that because it's an alphabet soup. But we do that shorthand. But CoCoRAS is a volunteer network of observers across the United States that provide weather information to us and to other entities. Now, I'm not a farmer. I don't proclaim to be a farmer. I was raised by a corn farmer, and I went to that college down there in Fargo.
When it was still the ag college.
When it was still...
Just kidding.
And so I know a little bit about agriculture, know the importance of weather into agriculture, and I don't know a farmstead that doesn't have a rain gauge on it.
Yeah. Exactly.
If we could get folks to volunteer into the COCORAS program, for example, we'd get more information than we need.
Mark, why don't you introduce this? You've got a team here, and this is just the gentleman you're about to introduce, former Air Force, I mean, the Sarge here. You know, the truth is he's just one piece of this team, but you got a lot of players here.
Speaking of the Weather Observer program, one of my, the man that I rely on probably the most heavy when it comes to the cooperative program for the maintenance of it, Brad Hopkins. Brad Hopkins is, as you indicated, a retired Air Force guy. Brad came to us. It's been, boy,
10 years.
10 years already.
On the 17th of this month, actually.
Wow.
We're not letting you go either. We're going to keep you here. You know that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
An Iron Ranger like you, you got to stay in North Dakota.
Oh, you bet.
So tell people what you do, Brad.
Well, like I say, or like Mark said, I kind of am his right-hand man. I do a lot of the field work. I do maintenance on the equipment. And part of the observer program is we provide the equipment. We provide the training to the observers. We set up the equipment, give them the instruction, and then they go from there and provide us the information. Now, what we've been doing here the last couple of weeks is the spring recharges. We have some weighing rain gauges out there that we just recently upgraded to electronic systems, and that's important because that's part of the climate network, but we need to service them twice a year, and we usually do that in the spring and fall, because nobody likes to go out and play with those at 20 below. Mm-hmm. So once the snow melts, we can get out there and service the gauges, make sure everything's running right, and make sure that there's no problems. Go back in the fall, empty things out, get things repaired. We address observer concerns. If there's any, at any time, if they have equipment problems, then they just give us a call, and we go out and fix that.
Like, so explain this to me. Joel Heitkamp goes in rural Hankinson, North Dakota, and decides he's going to be one of your weather observers and says, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to, you know, keep an eye on one of these sites. What does the job entail? What do I do?
Actually, it's pretty basic. One of the things that we have to do before we do bring an observer on board is do kind of a survey to make sure that the location that we're at is sufficient. You know, there's no obstructions. You don't want to put a rain gauge around a bunch of trees, mm-hmm. where the actual rainfall could be affected. Same thing with the temperature units. So what we do is make sure that the site is actually suitable for doing that, and the Weather Service has standards that we have to follow to make sure that everything is okay, because over time trees will grow. So when we do an initial sighting, we make sure that in the future we won't have to move that equipment. So once we determine that the site is okay, then we'd like to make sure that an observer will be there for the long term, because it does take a lot of time and effort to set up one of the stations. And usually when we get a replacement observer, it's a recommendation by somebody who's already been an observer. Say they quit for health reasons.
They know the mold. They know the model.
They know all of that stuff. So that goes a long way to helping us out. So then we set it up. We teach them how to take rain measurements, snowfall measurements, how to melt down the snow and get a liquid equivalent, and how to report it. And what we use nowadays is more through computer base. It's called WeatherCoder, and they're assigned their own ID and password to get into the system. And then all they do is go in and plug in the high and low temperatures for the day, the precipitation, and that instantly gets put into the database at the National Data Climate Center.
How much work?
For an observer, not very much, because they take the observations once a day.
For some of it's as routine as going to get their mail.
Yes, exactly.
And I bet you they eat it up like candy, some of these guys. There are so many people out there who just love to be able to track that, write it down, know it.
Absolutely. You know? And weather is one of those things, you either really like it or you really hate it. So the people that do this really enjoy doing it. And in some ways, they do become the focal point of the community, because wouldn't you like to be the guy who people come to, hey, what was the high and low, and how much rain did we get? And, you know, the local folks, you know, they talk, and so...
Yeah, I mean, the first thing they're going to talk about in any small town cafe It's the first thing they're going to talk. You know that, Mark. The first thing they're going to bring up. Now, you said you're short some of these people, right?
There are places, for example, Hankinson. You mentioned Hankinson down that area. It used to be the Sisters of the Presentation many, many years ago.
Yep.
But due to changes in, as Brad was talking about, changes in the topography, their mission changed. They didn't have the staffing to do it. They unfortunately couldn't continue to do it. So we lost them as an observer. And no one was able to step forward at that time to take it. So Hankinson is one example of where we lost a long-time weather observer. And it's been a little damp down in that part of
yeah, just North a little,
just
yeah.
Just a little.
And if you think about this for a minute, Joel, too, the observations that are provided by these people are actually used by the River Forecast Center down in Chanhassen, down there in the Twin Cities.
So it's valuable stuff.
Oh, it is very valuable, because what they're doing is help us help them. So the River Forecast Center takes this data, and they can plug it into their modeling system and come up with a forecast. And if you want to diverge a little bit, you know, how the rivers, you know, the depth of the channel and the width of the channel and everything is determined by the USGS. And so now you've got another federal agency that's involved with this process for flood forecasting, and they maintain most of the gauges. So when we're seeing river readings and stuff like that, sometimes a gauge will act up and the GS has to go out and fix it. So we're constantly, you know, talking with the River Forecast Center, and they in turn are talking with the GS, you know, as far as is a gauge acting up, how wide is the channel,
right.
You know, how much flow do you get from the water. So all of this gets taken into consideration when we're putting out the
river forecast. When we come back, the science of it all, the exact science of it all, because it's not. No one can expect you guys to be absolutely spot. I got an inch and a tenth. You said I was going to get an inch and two tenths. You know what I mean? Kind of a thing. So we're talking about the National Weather Service and some of those weather observers out there, but mostly the science that goes into this. And Mark, nothing can be harder than your job in the spring. To know what the river's going to do, what it isn't going to do, and then put equations in there. Look at what we just went through. We had a pretty easy spring in terms of being able to say, look, we're not going to reach 42 feet in Fargo. But then all of a sudden we get a great big rain, and water's moving through the channels fast, and the water came up quick. It's just not an exact science. I don't know how you – people expect things from you. I don't think that you're ever going to be able to deliver.
Meteorology and hydrology, 2 plus 2 equals 5. Tomorrow, 2 plus 2 is 3. Some days it's equal to 4, and that's it. There are so many unknowns about what goes on, and timing is a big deal. Had those rains fallen just right at the time of the little melt we had, it would have been a whole different story. Look how high the rivers got while the ground was still somewhat frozen. It could have been a whole different scenario had it occurred just 2 weeks earlier.
Do you guys take into a factor the depth of the frost? Because to me, it's, you know, the frost was so deep this year. Talk to some of the grave diggers and see what they've found. Talk to some of my rural water boys. You know, I talked to Tuna down there, and I said, well, he said we had lines freezing up, Joel, at 7 feet. And I said, well, how deep was the frost below that? And he looked at me like, has it been that long you've been out of this? We quit digging when we got to the pipe. You know, we weren't going to find out. We weren't going to keep going. But it was deep this year.
Well, there are some places that actually have a frost probe, and they can figure out the depth of the frost. And believe it or not, that is one of the parameters that the River Forecast Center also uses in their modeling. It's not just the water over the surface, but how much water is underneath the surface. What's the subsoil moisture? So that's just another factor that they look at when they put out the flood forecasts.
Well, when you look at what people are counting on right now, and what they're counting on is being able to get out in the field.
Absolutely.
Mark, what is the screen telling you right now that we're looking at?
Not good. Another system, as Terry was talking about, coming in, looking at some widespread inch-plus amounts, maybe even get some thunderstorms in the southern part of the valley that could jack that amount up, and then there's going to be the widespread rain on the backside of the system. So we're looking at another soaker. Is it going to be as bad as the one last week where we'll see 3-inch rainfalls? It's not out of the question, but more than likely 1 to 2.
As depressing as that is, I've got some news that might make you feel better about your lot in life, which is if you're in Minneapolis, what are you looking at?
Yeah, 3-4 inches.
Yeah, same thing in the Nebraska Panhandle. Big, heavy rains.
Yeah. And this is, talking to the guys last night, just sitting around here kind of BSing, this is going to be what May looks like, the way it sounds.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Okay. Guys, stick around. First off, we want this to be interactive. I haven't allowed that so far. Mark, I want you to take some phone calls. 237-5948, 1-800-880-5346. When we come back, we will take your phone calls. If you have a question or a comment, we can do just that. What I'm asking you to do is be part of it. Come on into News and Views right after this. Boys from the National Weather Service are digging your groove there, AI. That's right. They're busting a move up here. I will tell you, it's looking at the long-term projections of all of this, it's a little bit scary, guys. I'm sitting here talking with Mark and Brad from the National Weather Service, and is it a cycle that just we can't break out of, or what gets us out of this, Mark?
Yeah, when the pattern changes.
I know, but how? When? Come on, fix this for me.
Well, a lot
you're
of
the weather god.
A lot of it has to do with what's going on in the Pacific. The last 3 years, we've been in basically a cool phase ENSO, if you want the technical term. The Pacific Ocean waters have been cooler than normal, and that has a big influence on the weather across the world. And we tend to be weather sensitive to the Pacific. It has now started to warm, so we're probably for the first time since 2010 going to see something of a shift in the overall pattern. But it'll take a while for it to set in, because what happens in the Pacific, there's a lag of several months before the weather really starts to change here.
Okay. Well, let's get to the phone lines. Tim is on. He's apparently one of your weather observers. Tim, you're on News and Views.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I just want to tell people in the state, I work out west. The weather is just so fascinating. It gives you something to do. You look at it, you call it in, you see something, you know, when the silo goes sailing past your little camper. But it can be a lot of fun, too, because sometimes the guys will give you a heads up on what the radar's showing and stuff like that. So it's never a dull moment. I got to get back to work. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. Here's the thing that when you're in an ag base like this, and Brad, I'm going to throw this one to you. When you're ag base like this, so many of these guys are hanging on every word you say. It must be more of a pressure to almost always get it right.
Well, you have to approach it in the right way. These folks are doing us a great service, the observers out there. And for me personally, I consider it an honor to help these folks out. And for me, the challenge is getting it right, because they do rely on that. And as Mark said at the beginning of the show, protection of lives and property. But as you've seen so far, it is a little bit deeper than that. And so what we do is strive to put out the best product possible. And like you said, we don't always get it right, but we're always striving for improvement. So for me, yeah, is the pressure there? I don't allow it to be. I consider it a challenge to get it right for their benefit.
Mark, in your time's doing this, What's been the hardest part? In my mind, I'm like, spring, whether or not you're going to lose a town, 97. I mean, you were here for all of that and Grand Forks. I mean, what's the hardest part of this job?
Things like the 84 blizzard in Fargo, where there were lives lost, and we happened to know one of the young men who died in that blizzard, and that was very personal to us, and I was the forecaster that day, and it was a Saturday, and we couldn't get the message out because people didn't have the radios on because the weather was so nice, so they weren't receiving it. The technology, we didn't have smartphones at that time, so that was very difficult. Yes, the 97 flood. We're residents here. We caught a lot of heat because of the 97 flood, but people forget we lived here. We were displaced. My home was severely damaged. I lived here in the office because I couldn't live in my house for the better part of 2 months while I pumped the basement out. We're a part of the community. We don't just make these forecasts and throw them out there as if they're something to be just there. There is not a meteorologist in this office that if he puts a forecast out for a snowstorm, doesn't wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, seriously, looking out the window as it started to snow yet. We take the job very personally, but like Brad says, we also learn how to not let it get to us so that we're so defeated when we do make the bad forecast. And it does happen. It's not an exact science. And we don't gloat when we get the forecast right, because we know you're only one bad forecast away from looking foolish again. But it's constant improvement. The people forget. An extended forecast when we were in Fargo was Tuesday. An extended forecast would have been Wednesday and Thursday. Now we do extended forecasts out to 14 days that have a modicum of skill, where we can say it's going to be warmer than normal, colder than normal, wetter than normal, and really be able to pick these trends up that we had no envision of doing that 20 years ago.
I want to get to some of these messages that are coming at you by text. Some would say, please ask Mark, can you enter rainfall amounts in COCO Roz from a cell phone?
I believe they do have an app. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I know that the Cocoraz folks also, if you've got a smartphone, typically you've got a browser and you can log on to the website through your browser on your phone.
I'm working in Castleton, and we have been using a 2-foot diameter drill all winter. The frost was about 8 foot in that area this year. So 8 foot. I mean, think about that.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
And how many reports do you get in of what happens after a winter like we went through, with primarily open? You had a little more snow up here, well, quite a bit more snow than we did on the southern end of the valley. But you know, you saw that when you went out west too. You know, when I was in the Minot area, you know, just the frost had easy access to get as deep as it wanted to get. Some of the house shifting, some of the road shifting, you see it out there, guys. Mark, you know, have you seen anything as bad as what you did this last winter?
Not that I can remember right off the top of my head. The depth of the frost is the one thing, but I'm not terribly surprised, because, again, we had the drought in 12, but then we had enough rain and with the snow melt in the spring of 13, and we didn't have a flood because so much of that water, a big flood, I should say, because so much of that snow melt did go into the ground, but then now the ground is saturated at a deeper level because it took that water, percolated into the soil. So when it did freeze with bare ground or relatively low snow cover, boom, you got an instant ice cube.
237-5948, 1-800-880-5346. If you have a question or comment for Mark or any of his team here at the National Weather Service, when I, you know, take a look at all of these things, I always forget, you know, I'm sitting here thinking of loss of property, loss of everything that went with the flood here in Grand Forks, 97, Fargo, the ones that we fought so hard, Bismarck going through what they did, Minot going through what they did. You know, rivers, it seems to me to be a way tougher science. And Mark, am I making an assumption there, or are we getting better at projecting where river levels are going to come in at when they crest?
We are, for the most part. You get instances like last year where the percolation was just timed perfectly, so the water went into the ground just as the melt was really kicking into high gear. Had that melt occurred a week earlier, it would have been the 38, 39 foot crest that we originally predicted for Fargo. Instead, I showed you that video just a few minutes ago. Yeah. of the water going in the ground down by Davenport. That happened just at the perfect time. And yes, so it is more difficult. We're getting better, but then we're victims of our own success, because as the improvements come along, people naturally expect us to provide better services, failing to realize it's still an inexact science, even hydrology. Well, especially hydrology, because we know more about the atmosphere than we know about the subsoil.
Walk people through the electronics of this building, just physically what's in this building.
Well, this building was constructed in 1995. We took ownership of it in 96 when we opened in the spring of 96, so we've been here 18 years already. We have relatively state-of-the-art computer technology. We've got access to advanced satellite computer modeling. We've got telecommunication systems. We're on the high-priority and high-speed internet for our mainframes. I mean, we are a federal agency, so we're heavily firewalled, because actually the Weather Service public website's one of the heaviest, used to be one of the most hacked websites out there. People like to hack the Weather Service website, so we're pretty security conscious. We are a secure facility, again, because of being a federal entity. But we've got not just the technological aspects of it, but the people aspects. As I stated, the folks here take the job very seriously. Highly educated, highly motivated, dedicated folks who look at the forecast as not just something to be put out there, but something they know people are going to use.
I'll throw this to either one of you, but what role does this building play in aeronautics? You know, you're sitting here on one of the premier aeronautics campuses in the world, in the University of North Dakota. You know, and I'm sitting here sometimes on a runway in Minneapolis wanting to land in Fargo, and yet knowing that you're playing a role in that decision-making process on whether they're going to let the plane take off. And so, Brad, what do you think about that?
Well, we do issue aviation forecasts, and they're tailored specifically for five fields around the area. Obviously, Fargo, Grand Forks. We also have Devil's Lake, Thief River Falls, and Bemidji. So the aviation aspect is very important. Pilots fly off the observation, not the forecast. The forecast is used for planning purposes, but we're constantly monitoring that. In the system that we use, we have a program that monitors the observations that come in, so we can track what the observations are doing. We can also look at modeling data so that when we put out the aviation forecast, we have take that in conjunction with all the other tools that we have and generate a forecast. Now, as far as cross-country stuff, there is an Aviation Weather Center down in Kansas City. It's co-located with our Central Region headquarters, and they do a lot of the hazards like the icing and turbulence. Plus, you have aviation weather centers. Let's see, our local one, they're basically aviation weather units that specifically focus on the aviation aspects.
Well, once that pilot gets in the air, it's his determination, right?
Yeah.
It's their judgment, and that's one of the things I learned after 20 years in the Air Force is you know, having worked with pilots and having flown with pilots, that was one of the benefits of being in the weather career field in the Air Force is you got to know the pilots very well, and they would say, hey, come on and fly with us, and they would put me in the jump seat, and on climb out, we'd go through some bumps, and they'd turn to me and say, well, how would you classify that turbulence? And I would say, well, I'd probably call that light chop. And so I kind of impressed them a little bit because, so there's that connection between the aviation meteorologist.
There's an understanding.
There is an understanding. And so, you know, you get to see a lot in the aviation community, and I think that's helped me a lot, especially when I'm sitting at a workstation doing the aviation for the day.
I want to get Greg on with Mark. Go ahead, Greg.
Yes, Mark.
Yes, Greg.
We had a cabin up by Golden Lake in Steele County for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And quite a few years back, you had talked on the radio about there was three main west to east severe storm alleys kind of along Highway 2 and Highway 200 and Highway 46, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And you said you were studying that, and I was just curious if you ever... You'd mentioned it might have something to do with the lay of the land, you might say. And have you ever come to a conclusion about that? Or
that's a great point. Actually, we think of the plains being flat here in the Red River Valley, being this flat terrain. Huh. One of our meteorologists, who's now the warning coordination meteorologist, Greg Gust, positioned down in San Juan, Puerto Rico, he wrote his master's thesis on the very topic we're talking about. And due to the very subtle changes in topography within the Red River Valley, it affects the wind field. And that wind field can then affect the way tornadoes and severe weather form. Gary's paper showed that something called surface roughness, basically how the terrain changes over distance, allows our part of the country to have more frequent, weaker tornadoes, whereas parts of Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma that has a little more terrain, the wind has to be more turbulent, and that's why they have more frequent, bigger tornadoes, because it has more energy, has to overcome this low-level turbulence near the surface. So yes, the study is still actually going on. The paper was actually part of his master's thesis, and it was something John Enns, the former state climatologist at NDSU, he and I both had looked at this stuff back almost 20 years ago, 25 years ago. So it's still a work in progress. Part of it is getting the amount of data that we need, and it's a long-term issue.
Fascinating. So this explains why I believe that when the bad weather comes for us, it comes across the Siston Hills.
And there's actually a study done on the Sisseton Hills by the Aberdeen office in the severe weather that occurs down there that's unique to the Sisseton Hills area.
See, in my area, we believe that.
Yeah.
That we believe that that's the biggest factor that affects our weather. When we see it coming from there, in that little corner of North Dakota, we believe that we're much more affected by South Dakota than we are anywhere else.
And so, there is an impact.
Okay.